Welcome to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare, recovery coach professional. Do you love food, alcohol, drugs, sex, social media, cigarettes, or gambling a little too much? The traditional narrative says that addiction to these vices is the problem. The truth is, they are just symptoms. This hit show takes you from recovery to your ultimate life as my special guests and I help you discover how underneath every vice is the addiction to the suffering that developed due to unhealed trauma. So what can you do? Hungry for Answers provides groundbreaking, proven solutions from my best-selling spiritual book, Feast and Famine, Healing Addiction with Grace. It's time to stop suffering and start living your ultimate life. You have a divine right to a life filled with love, joy, peace, and abundance. Hungry for Answers starts now.
Hello, everyone. This is Robin, and welcome to Hungry for Answers. When I first spoke to my guest, Dennis Parhalakis, who is a certified money coach, about coming on, it was interesting because I said to him, you know, I'd like to do addicted to debt. And he said, no, it's actually addiction to spending. And then we started talking about all the situations in our personal life. And for me personally, spending in my personal life was not an issue, but spending in my own business was an issue. Like investing in my business and getting out of debt and then investing again and then getting out of debt. And so this show is really, we're going to be talking about, you know, just what is behind this idea of debting and why do we spend and how does it make us feel better? And so I'm really interested in this topic since it has impacted me personally. So please join me in welcoming Dennis to the show. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Robin. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you. I am well. And you?
Yeah, I'm very well. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Good. So, Dennis, the first question I ask all my guests is, have you ever been hungry for answers in your own life? And what answers did you receive?
Yeah, that's such a great question to start with. So I spent many, many years in finance, working in banks, and I kind of thought I knew a bit about money. And I realized that at some point I had a competence around money, but I wasn't financially secure, not an emotional sense. And the moment for me where answers started appearing was I was listening to a podcast because I was developing a program for financial literacy. And I listened to someone and she was talking about the origins of our money beliefs, our money behaviors. And I clearly remember it. I had this moment when I realized that the whole of my life, I had been dragging around my father's money anxiety. He was anxious about a lot of things, but money was certainly one of them. And I realized now that all the time I heard his voice in my head, and even when it's, you know, conscious or subconscious, his money anxieties had pervaded me. It was my subconscious inheritance. Among many things that we pick up in childhood, one of them is our relationship with money. And I realized then that it was his anxiety that had pervaded my life. And it gave me an insight into how do I get rid of it? How do I release myself from that? How do I unshackle myself from his anxiety, his negativity, and a whole bunch of other stuff? So that was my moment when I realized that, you know, the answer to being anxious is to recognize your anxiety, to call it out, and then to work on ways to unshackle yourself from it, and that's what money coaching led me to. That's how I got into money coaching, and that's what I help my clients with. And it's not always anxiety. It can be shame, it can be guilt, it can be jealousy, and it can be a whole bunch of things. And I'm sure we're going to talk about spending, so, you know, that's all part of how do I recognize, if I'm looking for the answer to why do I do this or why do I keep doing this, how do I stop doing this, how do I move towards the person I want to be, how do I make the future more easier easier rather than more difficult for myself? Mm-hmm. These are all amazing questions. And for me, that was my moment when the answers began to appear.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you talked a little bit about what was your journey to becoming a money coach. What was there anything, any type of like formal education you had to do? Because you had so much experience in the financial field.
I did. But funnily enough, as I mentioned, that just taught me to be competent with money, but not to understand my relationship with it. Yeah. So I went and I trained with the Money Coaching Institute of California, which is run by this amazing woman called Deborah Price. And I did a money coaching course, and then I did it again. And after that, I did a couple's money coaching course with her. So I spent most of 9 months working on understanding the relationship with money, understanding my relationship with money, and understanding the process of helping people to understand their relationship with money and build better relationships, better behaviors, and remove from them the behaviors that are undermining them, remove that from their lives. And then I've been doing this probably for about, I've been doing this for nearly 4 years now. So, and it's a continuous journey. It's a process of understanding yourself better every day. It's a process of research. It's a process of development. It's a process of trying to find ways to communicate with people. And a lot of it is learning how to ask questions and learning how to listen.
Yeah, because I'm not really sure that most people coming into a conversation with you, money coach, have an understanding that they have to get to the situations, the patterns, whatever you want to call it, that created their discomfort with money. And maybe their inability to manage it at the same time.
Yeah. Although most of the clients that I eventually work with have read the stuff that I put on my website, they've listened to my podcasts, they've looked at my blog. So in some senses, they're prepared for that conversation. Mm-hmm. And they are looking for answers. So they're looking for answers to questions like, you know, why do I do this? Why can't I stop this? Or how do I get better at this? And so if you look at people that come to coaching, or they come to therapists, or they come to counselors, they start off asking themselves, how do I do this? Mm-hmm. How do I learn about money? How do I manage my finances? How do I do this? And if they haven't been shown how, or if it's not natural for them, or if they have deep-seated challenges around it, they'll probably move to, why is this so difficult? Why is this so hard? And then if that space usually transitions into, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
And that's because that's a lot of the messaging we get. This is when you were at school, you were told, this is really simple. What's wrong with you? Why don't you get this? What's wrong with you? Why did you do that? What's wrong with you? And so we internalize this, and it's not just around money. It's around a whole number of things, you know, exercise, dieting, all these things that are actually quite difficult for us as human beings, because we didn't evolve to be careful eaters. We didn't evolve to manage our money. We didn't evolve to really think about the future at all. We've spent most of the last 3 or 4 million years trying to stay alive in the present. Mm-hmm. And so this concept of doing things that are good for future Robin, or doing things that are good for future Dennis, just doesn't really sit within us physiologically and neurologically. We have to train ourselves. So saving is a learned experience. Mm-hmm. Our ancestors didn't leave food lying around. You know, if they saw it, they ate it, right? Food. For most of humanity's existence, there's been food scarcity. You didn't leave an apple on the ground, and our bodies are wired to consume energy sources whenever they found them. The two main energy sources are sugar and fat, and so we are wired to consume them whenever possible, and our bodies then store them because you don't know when you're going to need it. when you look at kind of trying to manage your relationship with food in the context of what you're hardwired to do, it makes far more sense that it's difficult and it has to be a learned behavior. It's just not natural. And so within the context of managing your finances, unless people showed you how to save, for example, how are you going to learn how to save? Right? It's just not there. And as kids, we grow up, and what do we see our parents doing? We see them spending money. So we know how to do that. That bit's fairly obvious, right? But the concept of putting money away, saving it, investing it, doing whatever all those aspects of financial management, unless somebody shows you, it's just not a natural human activity.
You know, it's interesting you talk about children. My daughter, when she was younger, she was saving money and she wanted an American Girl doll. And my mom said, I'll pay for half of it.
Right.
And so I said to Gabby, you have to pay for the other half. And she said, how much is it? And I said, your half, I think, was like $60. And she said, so that means that if I have $100 in my savings and I use this 60, I'll only have 40 left in my savings. And I said, yes, that's correct. And she said, well, maybe I really don't want that American Girl doll that much. So she was making a conscious decision about saving there. Like she knew that if she spent that money, she wouldn't have the money anymore. So I was really happy with that outcome because it felt to me that she was really being mature. I mean, literally, I think she was like 8 or 9, but making a decision.
Yeah, she's being conscious, which is the main thing. I think it's very easy as parents, we get very easily triggered around our kids' spending behaviors. But it's for them, it's just money. If you give a kid a chocolate bar and they eat all of it, you don't go, oh, don't do that. You're going to be overweight for the rest of your life. But if we give kids money and they spend all of it, we go, whoa, no, you're going to be broke, you're going to be bankrupt and whatever. So we transmit our own fears around it because money has this resonance, has this real importance. And so kids' behavior with money is based on kids' behavior with anything, plus what they see us doing. So I think she had that's a really sensible, mature, conscious decision-making process. And I like the way that you framed it with you need to contribute. I'm not going to buy it for you, but if you put half in, we'll put half in. So that it's a really nice way of engaging with the process of going, okay, if you save some, you can have it. So there's lots of really, really positives around that conversation, around that framing of how you create a saving and a spending decision.
Yeah.
So very nice indeed. I think my message here is just, as parents, we can be highly judgmental around what our kids do with money when in fact they're just learning what to do with it.
Yes, for sure. So at the beginning, I talked about that I thought that this show was about an addiction to debt. And you corrected me early on and said, we are addicted to spending and not addicted to debt. Debt is perhaps the outcome of spending. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, you've as an addiction coach or as a recovery coach, the behaviors that people have around addictive behaviors like spending, like eating, like gambling, and all the things that you mentioned in your intro are really reflective of an underlying need that isn't being met. And so we're trying through the medium of in our case, spending, to try and make ourselves feel better, to try and meet the unmet need. And so in a sense, it's not, debt is the result of spending more than you have.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that we're addicted to debt so much. It just leads, if you can afford heavy spending, if you're in an incredibly lucky and privileged position and you can essentially spend whatever you want, then the addictive behavior is the spending, not the debt. So that's why I just wanted to tease that out a little bit. Debt is the enabler. So we've had spending before we had debt. What has changed and quite dramatically in the last 30, 40 years is that we've democratized debt. And what I mean by that is that everybody can have it.
Yeah.
So previously you couldn't get into debt. That just wasn't available to you if you didn't have the money. You couldn't buy whatever it was. And we're not going back very far. We're probably going back to pre-1960. I think the first credit cards came out in the US in the late 1950s. So debt in that sense, based around credit, was not, you know, just wasn't available, not in the way we understand it now. But we've also normalized it. Mm-hmm. So the concept of having debt, the concept of being in debt, which has been quite an emotive subject really for the last 5,000 years. There's a fantastic book by a guy called David Graeber called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And it, you know, really goes into, you know, why our relationship with debt at a societal level is so challenging for many people, because actually if you had debts and you couldn't repay them, up until, you know, let's say 500 or 600 years ago, you ended up in slavery. So this debt issue from a society's perspective is really just another angle around power. Who has power over whom? So that's, you know, debt is the result of spending more than you earn when you look at it from the spending perspective. So, you know, the other thing that's changed over the last 40 years is that we've created, or the, you know, the society we live in has created this income gap. The gap between rich and poor has stretched dramatically. And normally this creates a consumption gap. So if you don't have the money, you don't buy the thing, which means that other people have things that you don't have because they've got more income, and you know, society tends to become a little fractious around that. But with credit and debt, we've financed this consumption gap. And we have, or you know, the financial services industry has, with the blessing of politicians and regulators, found ever more ways to finance or provide credit to debt. I don't know if you have it in this country, but now you can buy a pizza on Klarna. Klarna is a buy now, pay later series. You can buy a pizza on it. You know, and to me, this is just utterly terrible state of affairs. If you can't afford a pizza, and I'm deeply sympathetic for people who find themselves in that position, then really putting it on a repayment plan is just the ultimate problem. It's creating the ultimate problem.
Yeah, one of the big things we're in a lot of conversation on in our country is what's the word I'm looking for? The student loan forgiveness.
Sure.
Because, you know, there's such a high number of student loans out there that it's actually impacting the rest of the economy. You know, people cannot buy things because their student loans are so high. So it's interesting when you listen to the back and forth between the people who are for it and the people who are against it. And, you know, that becomes one of those things you have to, you know, if invest in your education to get ahead. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody has to go to a four-year college, but there's an investment, right? You're spending potentially what you don't have, and then you have debt. So we're actually going to go to a break. Let's pick this conversation up when we return. You're listening to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare.
You've been listening, but are you watching? Tune in to your favorite shows on the Transformation Talk Radio Facebook page. We stream live video podcasts every day, and we love to hear from you. Leave comments and questions for the host to address live, on the air, and get to know the faces behind the voices you love. Just go to Facebook and search for Transformation Talk Radio.
Yeah, yippee skippy to that, baby.
Have you heard about shifting the collective vibration and consciousness on the planet? Join me, Kimberly Barrett, on the Sharing Love and Light show every first and third Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern at transformationtalkradio.com to explore the depth of vibration and consciousness on our planet and learn how you can shine your love and light. To learn more, visit sharingloveandlightshow.com.
Champion your life with me, Leanne Champion, first and third Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com. That new gym membership might help you get fit, but what about emotional fitness? Jump into the rushing waters of personal growth. Don't waste another minute feeling unfulfilled. Visit championyourlife.com and let's do this together.
Not just talk, conversation for profound self-awareness. Stick with us. Your best life awaits on TransformationTalkRadio.com. What did you say your name was?
Welcome back to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare. To learn more about my work, please go to clarity.com. That's clarity.com. And I'm here with Dennis Harhalakis. And Dennis, how can people reach you?
Thank you, Robin. So you can find me at www.cambridgemoneycoaching.uk. So Cambridge Money Coaching is all one word.
Nice. Thank you. So we were, before we went to the break, we were talking about the student loan forgiveness issue here in the UK. And Dennis said to me on the break that a good conversation about this, or a good way to talk about this, would be to talk about good debt versus bad debt. So Dennis, why don't you explain that to our audience?
Yeah. Thank you, Robin. So I think because, you know, the whole debt space is full of judgment. And, you know, one of the things that debt tends to be associated with, and we've already talked about this, is spending. And so debt too much debt tends to be classified as you got a spending problem. And I just want to put it out there that for a lot of people, their debt is because it's an income problem. They have an income problem. And debt is a way to get by, to try and manage the gaps and the uncertainty of income. So it raises the question of good debt versus bad debt. And you touched on that when we talked about student debt. And so when I say good and bad, I don't mean in any judgmental sense. I just mean from a financial sense, because investing in yourself is actually one of the most important things you can do. An investment as such, which essentially means saving some money and investing into something that grows, something that has value, maybe the stock market, maybe yourself, you know, maybe even housing. I'm not getting into the kind of, you know, what you can put your money into, but that is a way to build wealth. And that has been the traditional way to build wealth over time. So good debts are ones that leave you better off in the long term. So they build wealth, they pay for themselves over time. They have a clear and specific reason for taking them out and a realistic plan for paying back. I mean, usually they're the result of shopping around for cheap funding. So your mortgage debt is considered to be okay. Student loan debts, study courses. If you have to borrow money to buy a car that takes you to work, all of those things are debts that is debt in the positive sense, that it's making the future better for you rather than worse for you. And bad debt is the opposite. So it's not affordable. It drains wealth, no realistic plan of paying for itself, and is usually decided in a hurry and financed by expensive credit. So that's the area where we're talking about unrestricted spending. That's the area where we're talking about borrowing money to buy something that you don't necessarily need right in that moment in time, but you're putting it on a credit card, which essentially means that it may well cost you 30 to 50% more over the lifetime of paying it back. So one of my kids needed a computer. So we went to look at computers and there was $1,000 for a computer. And it was payable back over 36 monthly payments. And the way I explained it to him at that point in time was, well, you can pay $1,000, or actually it was going to be me anyway. I can pay $1,000 just for you right now, or you can pay $1,000. But especially for you, I'll make you a special price. Why don't you pay $1,300 instead? Because if you put it, you know, we put down $30 now and pay it back over the next 36 months, that same computer will cost you $1,300. So I was just trying to illustrate with him, for him, you know, once you read the small print, and it's all there, what is the total final cost? It's 30% more than paying for it right now. So we're back to the question of, you know, can I afford it? Can I borrow some money? Can I save up for some money? Because why would I pay 30% more for something? And so this, you know, that I think it's worth teasing out the good debt versus bad debt side of things, because you need to be able to understand what a good financial decision looks like, and yeah, something that's going to make you worse off in the long term. Now, if you needed that computer for work, you know, and that computer was an investment and something that was going to make you money later on, you know, then very possibly then buying it on credit made sense, but not when you're paying 30 or 40% credit interest, because essentially is making you poorer over time.
You had chatted with me earlier about the decision process called HALT.
Yeah,
it was very interesting. Can you share that?
Yeah, so that comes back to, you know, good debt versus bad debt. And so in the context of bad debt, a lot of bad debt decisions are made when you're in HALT. So HALT is a really fantastic acronym, which stands for hungry, anxious or angry, lonely or tired. So we make bad decisions. We're human beings. We make bad decisions. We make bad decisions a lot of the time, but we make bad decisions when we're hungry, because we don't have enough energy to run the conscious part of our brains. Hungry and tired, we don't make good decisions when we're hungry and tired. I think there's no one that's going to disagree with that. And we don't make very good decisions when we're anxious or angry or lonely, because our brain is flooded with cortisol. Cortisol is not a happy space to be in. It produces this thing called cognitive narrowing, where essentially your ability to think is reduced. And so, yeah, I mean, one of the things that comes up for me when I talk about this in financial well-being seminars and webinars is, if you're on Amazon 3 o'clock in the morning buying stuff, you're probably not making good decisions. I have no judgment around this. It's not a judgment question. It's like, you know, what are you really doing on there? So HALT, leave it in the basket, and see if you still feel like you want it in the morning.
I did that with this sweater.
Good.
I put it in the basket and then I halted, because it was in the middle of the night. And the next, a couple of days later, my husband was buying something on Amazon. He goes, "Do you still want that orange sweater that's in the basket?" And I'm like, "Oh, I forgot about it." Like, so it really wasn't that important to me.
So HALT, yeah, you didn't need it right there. And when you came back, when you were in a non-HALT state, then you can make a more rational decision. It's like, you know, you're feeling better. You whatever it was that was driving you to Amazon at 3 o'clock in the morning is no longer present. One of the other acronyms that we use is WAIT, which means, what am I thinking? So there's a guy called Daniel Kahneman, who is the pioneer of behavioral psychology, behavioral science. And he's written something which I think is, you know, just basically anything that speeds people up instead of slowing them down is going to cause more impulsive and uncritical behavior. And so, you know, if we go back to our childhood, and you were at 3 o'clock in the morning feeling not great for yourself, with yourself, and you wanted something that's going to make yourself feel better, you couldn't spend, right? There was no internet, there was or no online. And one, as I recall, you know, one of the things that we wanted to talk about was frictionless spending. So let's go back to your childhood. Let's go back to your childhood and walk me through how you would go about buying something. You're like 10 or 15 years old and you've got a little bit of money saved up or something or other. How did you go about buying stuff that you wanted for yourself?
Yeah, so for me, because I grew up before the internet, you know, it would be going to the mall,
Where did you get the money from?
Where did I get the money from? At 15, could have been from holiday gifts or babysitting.
Right.
Something.
So you had some cash saved up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And although my parents were almost too generous with, you know, if we said we wanted something, the money seemed to always be there for what we wanted.
That's nice. So how far away was the mall?
Not too far, maybe like 10 minutes.
Okay. Is that 10 minutes on your bike, 10 minutes by car, 10 minutes?
Well, we also had a downtown that we lived just down the street from the downtown area. And so we could walk there and buy things downtown as well. I'm actually right. envisioning myself walking into the record store.
Oh, yeah.
It was called Igor's Record Store. So that's where we, you know, records were huge then. Vinyl, I think, is what they call it now.
Mm.
But, you know, buying albums was just a huge spend for all of us.
Right. And so you go to the mall and you've got Igor's and you've got a few other shops.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty much it, I'm guessing, is that? So you have what you have. You've saved some money up in advance. It's cash only. You don't have the cash. You don't get anywhere, right? You don't go to Igor and you go, I've only got $5. Can I just, you know, owe you the rest? Igor's not gonna give you credit. And so, you know, that process is cognitive, it's deliberative. You know, you have to walk there, you're excited, you buy a few records, you come home. And so if we contrast that to where we are now, which means that you, I, and your kids and my kids can just sit in front of a screen and they can buy anything they want. So one of the things that used to happen was, you know, if you didn't have the record you wanted, or they didn't have the pair of pants you wanted, or they didn't have the whatever you wanted, you couldn't go. There wasn't any choice in the matter, right?
Right.
You just,
right.
You know, you didn't have that. You had to go back home, and maybe you went back the next week or the next month or whatever. But now I can sit here and I can find on Amazon and anywhere else, I can easily find something to spend my money on. And so the friction, the process of going to the mall, the process of saving the money, the process of spending the money, all of that is now frictionless. I'm sitting here, I can click. And now, if I don't have a credit card, someone will probably give me credit at point of sale. So now I have frictionless spending, I have frictionless debt, and I'm also told that if I don't like it, I can send it back. Mm-hmm. So I've got frictionless returns. All of this stuff is going to speed up our spending. And as Kahneman says, it's going to cause impulsive and uncritical behavior. One click, the worst. I had one click for a while, and then I realized, oh, no, this is a really bad idea. The yeah. reason that one click exists is to reduce friction around the spending process to its absolute minimum. Storing your credit cards online, oh, that's really nice. No, it isn't. It's not for your benefit. It's to reduce cart abandonment, to use a technical term. And it's to reduce the friction. So if you have to type in your credit card details every single time you want to make a purchase, that is friction. And so that
I can say, even in my life, I have abandoned the cart if I've had to put my credit card in. Because
sure.
maybe I didn't have it on me, or it just. So that's the friction, right? The friction is they want to avoid the friction of us challenging ourselves as to whether or not we want to make the buy.
Totally. They want to reduce the friction between, I feel bad, I need to buy something, oops, there it is the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Make that process as frictionless as possible, and you reduce the chances that people will abandon their purchasing.
So this sort of leads me to a question that I had, and that is, there a correlation between how I feel about myself and how I feel about money?
Sure. There's a correlation. Well, yeah. So there's a correlation in the sense that if I'm feeling bad about stuff, I may end up spending money. because we are, as a society, we're not very good at promoting healthy ways to healthy ways of self-regulation. We're surrounded by unhealthy regulation. Buy this, you know, is generally the answer. Eat this, invest in this. That's, you know, all I'm. So, you know, healthy regulation, which you do need to learn as a child, and certainly as an, you know, for adult life, it's generally not, you know, so obvious. It's not, you know, it's not promoted so much. Mm-hmm. So in terms of my relationship with money, is made up of how I feel about myself, how I feel about money, and how I feel about money in myself. So how I feel about myself and how I feel about money are connected through the medium of my relationship with money. They're a set of beliefs. So people who are good with their finances, people who have a healthy relationship with money, we start with, how do I feel about myself? So this just, you know, as a small sidebar, people who are healthy in general, in other words, they exercise, or they, you know, they manage their spending, or they have a healthy relationship with food, they all generally start from a position of feeling good about themselves, because then they don't need to spend or eat or whatever it is to make themselves feel better. So that's a cornerstone of our relationship with anything, is how do we feel about ourselves? So if I'm good with my finances, I'm competent, I have confidence in my knowledge and decision-making processes, I take ownership of my outcomes, right? I have agency. I believe in you know, I have control, and my self-worth does not depend on my net worth or my possessions. So that's when I feel good about myself. If I feel good about money, then money is a tool to achieve well-being. It's not the work of the devil, the root of all evil, something we don't talk about. It's not this unknown or confusing thing that I don't understand. So that's money. I mean, money gets a bad rap. But you know, it's really neutral in many senses of the word. What people do for money isn't great, but money in itself is you know, it's just essentially the way we transact. And when I feel good about money in myself, then money or thinking about money doesn't make me feel anxious or ashamed, guilty, regretful. So, you know, then I'm comfortable engaging with the financial system. And at a core identity level, when I feel good about money and myself, I am the kind of person who manages their finances well. So those three parts form a healthy relationship with money. A healthy relationship with money drives positive financial behaviors, things that allow you to build wealth, allow you to save, or help you to save, and yeah, create the create your financial future.
That's great. So we're gonna go to a break, our second break, and then we'll continue this conversation when we return. You're listening to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare, and we'll be right back.
Of not losing the weight? You need a healthy solution for weight loss that protects your muscle mass as the fat burns away naturally. Holistic Medical Center has the healthy option for your weight loss concerns. Lose 1 to 3 pounds per day in 21 days, naturally, under our physician supervision. Call Holistic Medical Center 425-451-0404 or on the web, drdarvish.com, drdarvish.com.
If you've ever had a broken heart, you know how painful that can be and how long it can sometimes take to heal it. I'm Megan Edge, author of The Heart's Journey, Healing Hearts, Oracle Cards, and Guidebook, published with Balboa Press and Hay House. In The Heart's Journey, I share with you my own heartbreak and how I healed it through the beautiful hearts that found me in nature. From taking photographs of these hearts for myself, I've created this beautiful toolkit, which includes the guidebook, which has my story, how to work with oracle cards as a healing tool, and the story of each of these hearts as they cross my path. I've also created a beautiful journal. There's a pen, a bookmark, and of course, the 42 Healing Hearts Oracle Cards. You can order The Heart's Journey, Healing Hearts, Oracle Cards, and Guidebook through my website, meganedge.ca, through Balboa Press, Amazon, and many other places online or your local shops. I look forward to hearing about your heart's healing.
Do you ever wonder why you are put here on this earth? What your soul is being called to do? What brings you the greatest satisfaction? Tune in to the Personal Wisdom Show with Mita Johnson on TransformationTalkRadio.com, where she will help you learn to really lean in and trust the wisdom and power within you, creating a success you never thought possible. If you want to grow this wisdom inside you and understand your life purpose, visit PersonalWisdomCoachingNow.com.
Looking for the next Can't Put It Down book? Pick up Unapologetically Favored by Courtney Cottrell, 21-year active duty master chief with the U.S. Navy and motivational speaker. See this beautiful coming-of-age story unfold through the eyes of a true leader. A testimony of tenacity, faith, and self-love that will have you embarking on your own path of self-discovery. Visit unapologeticallyfavored.com to learn more about Courtney and her work.
Hello, welcome back to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare. And to learn more about my work, please go to www.clarity.com. That's C-L-A-R-E-I-T-Y. And you can find me on Instagram, Clarity by Robin, or Facebook, Clarity with Robin. And I'm here with Dennis Harhalakis. And Dennis, he is a certified money coach. How can people find you?
You can find me at www.cambridgemoneycoaching. That's one word, cambridgemoneycoaching.uk. Thank you.
UK, that's great. Yeah. So Dennis, here's the big question. Why is managing money so hard?
Yeah, thank you for asking me that, because I think it's really important that people, because we all struggle to a certain extent with our finances, and it is hard. Right? And once you understand that it's hard, I think we can be far less judgmental about other people and also about ourselves. So the fundamental level is our brains are not wired for it. Our brains are wired for short-term gratification and immediate response to danger. So if there's something I want, the best time to have it is now. So, and the best time to pay for it is into the future. So wherever possible, we push discomfort into the future. So when's the best time to start that training program, get on that diet, sort out my finances? In the future. Logically, you know, when you engage your rational brain, the best time to do it is now. But emotionally, it's always in the future. And we're pretty much always ruled by our emotions. So secondly, over the last 70 years, as we touched on, finances have got very complex. Right? We've got credit, we've got the practical disappearance of cash. I don't know if it's the same in the US, but in the UK, we don't really get bills anymore. We just get an email saying, you can log on to your account and get your latest bill here. Debit cards, credit cards, stored value cards, pay now, buy now, pay later. And we have direct debits and standing orders. So essentially the money just, leaks out of the account without us really ever really knowing about it. And all this complexity makes us anxious. And when we're anxious, a halt sometimes kicks in. And for humans, the two biggest stressors are uncertainty and lack of control. And I think that sums up most of our finances these days. So it's tricky, but also most of the time, no one's ever shown us how. All of my clients, none of them's ever shown them how. And you can say, that's because they're coming to a money coach. Obviously, they've never been shown how to manage money, but I think most people still struggle with that. They haven't. And we touched on, no one ever showed you how to save. Well, that's right, because saving is not a normal activity. That's not an activity that is part of our, unless it's shown as part of your upbringing, that doesn't happen. And we don't start with a blank slate. So we have a subconscious inheritance. Mine was anxiety. So that's kind of one of the better ends of it, but it's subconscious and it drives our behavior. Most of our beliefs about who we are, how families behave, how the world works, all of that comes from the environment in which we grew up. And very often that, includes self-limiting beliefs.
And so Dennis, just real, just curious, with all the clients that you've seen, what do you see as these self-limiting beliefs that may have come from our family of origin? Where do you see the most what are the most prevalent ones?
They vary. Most of the problems that people have are because they've never been shown how to manage their finances. So self-limiting beliefs, for example, can be, one client, for example, had a self-limiting belief around engaging with the financial system, mm-hmm. which meant that when he had credit card debt, he never really did anything with it, and it just built up because he had an irrational fear of speaking to bank managers. So that's, for example, you know, something that came directly from his childhood. Other clients have developed more usually a fear around finances because money was a huge source of conflict in their early lives. So money becomes associated with anger and shame and shouting and regret, and all of those things mean that when you're trying to manage your own finances, but every time you try and have a conversation with your partner maybe about it, or even, you know, look at your own credit card bills, it brings up all of that anxiety from your childhood. So mm-hmm. it's always colored by what went on around money when you're growing up. So some of those, you know, so self-limiting beliefs could be, I'm no good with finances. You know, I've always been in debt. My mother was in debt. My father was in debt. You know, all those things that we kind of use to avoid engaging with something that causes us discomfort. And then when we have this thing around financial education, tends to be this austerity gospel, you know, to separate wants and needs, and it's all about maths and, you know, what don't you understand? When in fact, most of our behavior is driven by emotion, and it's the same around money. So all these things build up. And a lot of the time, we're told that expressing emotions is unsafe. The word emotional has very negative connotations to it. So when our finances causes us discomfort, we tend to step away from it. Now, if your arm hurts or your leg hurts or whatever, you'll go, well, I need to go and see a doctor about this. But when you've got maybe, you know, because there's a cultural silence around money, when you feel shame, guilt, anxiety, regret around your finances or your money or your engagement or your credit card bills or your debt, or whatever it is, who do you go and talk to?
Yeah, nobody.
Because that shame and self-judgment follows us around, and we go back to, well, why do I have this debt? What's wrong with me? Why can't I manage my finances? What's wrong with me? And when you think there's something wrong with you, it's very, very difficult. So my overriding message around this area is, if you have debt, if you can't manage your spending, if you can't spend anything, if you've got no savings, if you've got no investments, if you live, you know, always on the edge, there's nothing wrong with you. It's totally normal. This stuff's complex. The world is a difficult place to navigate. It's getting increasingly difficult. And if no one's ever shown you how, it's not your fault. And so I come, you know, really with a message of compassion and self-forgiveness in this space. Because, again, money's tied into our self-worth. And, yeah, it's a core survival. We need it. And so all of our behavior around it is tied into emotions, is tied into into this areas of self-worth. So you know, when I work with clients around this, it's about helping them understand why they got to where they got to, forgiving themselves for it, and then going, okay, how do we change the future going forward? So for me, how do I change my money anxiety? How do I reduce my money anxiety, and how do I reduce the bad decisions that being in a scarcity mindset produces? How do I be more generous?
There is always time to improve. There's time to get out of your situation if you learn the skills to do better. And so what would you say are the key drivers of financial well-being and healthy finances?
Thank you. This is my work in this area is based on a lot of the work that was done by a guy who wrote a book called The Millionaire Next Door. And he identified four key things that help people to build wealth. And you need all four. They're kind of the cornerstone of a healthy relationship with money. And having a healthy relationship which with money is the underpins all this. So the first one is this horrible word called frugality. It's not very nice. It sounds very constricting, and I haven't found a better word with it in years. But anyway, it basically means don't spend all you earn. You need to save. And I do know this is really difficult for a lot of people, because sometimes there just isn't money to save. There isn't enough to save. But building financial security requires a level of saving. So engaging with your finances is the process where you can find some money to save.
Okay.
Confidence is developing the skills and ability to maintain wealth. So this is where financial literacy sits, but it's also where budgeting, planning sits. Planning is a key driver of financial well-being, because the longer you plan ahead, the more income people have saved. Responsibility is the third one. It's taking ownership and responsibility for your financial outcomes. You don't blame the system, the government, the economy, maybe the patriarchy, because these are things you cannot control. So it's easy and convenient to blame them. But the minute you start blaming outside factors, you lose not only your power and motivation to turn things around, but also the ability to do so. So at the same time, I think, you know, believing that external factors have more power over your future than your own actions or choices is a recipe for stress and losing sleep. So, you know, one way to look at this is we only have one life. I mean, you know, at a time, I don't have views on reincarnation, but the only life I know about is the one I'm living right now. So, you know, if you're not in control of it, who is? You know, why would you allow someone or something else to control the one life you have to live? So responsibility is focusing on what you can control, taking ownership of it, and learning how to make good decisions around it. And the final one is this term social indifference, which is the ability not to be influenced by the spending behaviors and possessions of others. And this goes right back to these trends in consumer goods and services and endless messages from the media to buy this, wear this, drive that. And this is the, you know, the origin of comparing up. But the more you compare up, the more stress you have, the less your satisfaction. And the contradiction for me at the heart of this compulsive consumption that we're encouraged, and they've made it as easy as us as possible with frictionless spending, is it's not any of the things that we already own that will make us happy, but it will be the very next thing that we buy.
Yeah.
Now that's going to tip us into a state.
That's going to make us happy.
Right.
And one of the questions I had was, when we choose to feel good up front and pay for it later, what is the underlying message we are telling ourselves? And it sounds like you just answered that when you said, this next purchase is the one that's going to make me feel good.
Well, that's so if we're back to buy now, pay later, I mean, really, you know, that's just human being. If I said, Robin, I'm going to, you know, there's something really nice that you want and someone else is going to pay for it, what would you say?
Yes.
Okay. Now, that someone else happens to be future Robin. Future Robin's got to pay for it.
All it's right. True.
But, you know, in general, if I said, you know, I'll buy you this handbag, this piece of music, whatever it is, you go, yeah, sure. So buy now, pay later has this way of, or credit cards or whatever has this way of splitting. I get the nice thing now and someone else, future Robin, has to deal with the payment for this. So that's just being human. And, you know, what you have to recognize is whether or not, you know, that's putting it on a credit card is worth it. If that's just because you pay off your credit card every single month, then, you know, that's fine. That's just a way of money management. But if you're putting it on a credit card because you don't have the money now and you don't have it in a month and you don't have it in 3 months, then you're choosing to pay 30% or 40% more for it, which is bad debt. And I mean that not judgmentally. I mean that just, you know, from a financial
perspective. Yes, it's not a good decision is what we mean by bad debt. So yeah. we're coming to the end of the show, and you know, I really want to say it doesn't feel well. It doesn't feel good to be overwhelmed with debt. And I think what we've learned on this show is that you need to really stay very present with this situation, because you can, there are tools that you can use to get out of your debt situation. There are tools that you can use to find out, why are you spending? What is it that you're struggling with? What are you suffering over? What is going on in your life? And how can you feel better without buying that next thing, which will very quickly after you buy it make you feel bad about it? So take a look at that, folks. There are resources out there. Dennis is one of them. And there are, you know, folks that you can talk to about how you're feeling so that you don't have to use spending as another addictive vice for you. Or, as always, you can go inside of yourself and connect to your own inner divinity to establish a more healthier relationship with your own self. And with that, I'm going to say goodbye. And Dennis, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate you being here.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Robin. Thank you so much.
And you're welcome.
Good luck to all your listeners.
Thank you. And until next time, everyone, you're listening to Hungry for Answers, and we'll see you, talk to you soon.
Thank you for tuning into Hungry for Answers. Learning to love ourselves is the one true solution to addiction. Make a commitment to healing today and see how you can reach your ultimate potential. Remember, you have a divine right to a life filled with love, joy, peace, and abundance. To learn more about me and my offerings, please go to clarity.com. That's Claire, C-L-A-R-E-I-T-Y.com. See you next time.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.